This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. There are any number of private testing services that will decode your DNA, catalog the foreign chemicals in your blood, and identify the bacteria living in and on your body. So it might come as a surprise that if you sign up for an actual biomedical research study, you might not be privy to what the scientists learn about you. There are valid reasons for that, but times and technology and social norms are all changing quickly, and the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine say science needs to change too. A new report recommends that scientists do return personal data to study participants whenever feasible, and that they think about how to do so responsibly before they even start a study. Jeffrey Botkin is a professor of pediatrics and an adjunct professor of human genetics at the University of Utah. He chaired the committee that created that new report and recommendations. Jeffrey, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you. Good morning.
Researchers typically have not given study participants their personal data, or at least that hasn't been the standard practice. Why not?
Well, for a couple of reasons. For one, the emphasis of research, of course, is different than clinical care. You would expect your clinician, if you're involved with getting your normal health care, to get any results back to you from any tests that are run. But in the research context, the focus isn't so much on individual welfare, but it's really on trying to answer general questions about human biology or human disease. And so it hasn't been focused on the individual. And I think folks have been concerned that by returning results, folks will blur the line between clinical care and research and perhaps make inappropriate decisions based on an uncertain research finding that might be disclosed during the research process.
Given that concern, then, what prompted the National Academies and the biomedical research field as a whole to reexamine this practice and end up recommending, at least on a broad level, that results should be shared with participants at least more frequently than has been the case in the past?
Well, this has been a controversy in recent years to a large extent due to the expansion of genetic research. And what's happening in that domain is that many investigators are trying to find genetic markers that are associated with a disease process to try to better understand the disease. And in doing that, they're doing a lot of genome sequencing, meaning taking someone's entire genome and coding that out. Now, what happens in that circumstance is that investigators oftentimes are coming across genetic markers for well-known diseases. So they may be looking for an association for a particular disease, but they come across a marker that, indicates that the person is at increased risk for breast cancer or colon cancer. And then the question is, so what do we do with that information? Don't we have an obligation to return that to people, or don't we? Or what are the limits and the appropriate approach to returning that kind of result? So that's fostered quite a bit of literature emerging out of the genetics realm, and really has asked or posed the question more broadly to say, all right, let's rethink our tradition of not returning results and think through when is it most appropriate to return results and when is it most appropriate to not to return results.
Particularly when we're talking about genetic data, there are now who knows how many different private companies, you know, 23andMe, Ancestry.com, some of the best known ones, but a lot of these different private services that will give you exactly the kind of information you were just talking about, whether or not you do carry a gene that is a known risk for breast cancer or prostate cancer or some other disease. Has that market and that, new trend in the availability of genetic information also been a factor in this discussion within the research field?
I think not directly, but probably indirectly, and it sort of highlights the expanded access to information that people now have, and probably highlighting people's interest in learning more about themselves personally. And I think what the research pretty clearly shows is that even when you tell people in the research process or in the consent process that we're not going to return results to you, that in fact people expect results to be returned, and they can be somewhat frustrated and disappointed when there's not that level of communication. So I think the expansion of interest in the general public and consumer rights to a certain extent has also been a factor in this discussion.
It also seems like it could intersect with the public discussion just about data rights and data privacy, people wanting to have more control and more awareness about the data about themselves that exists in various different realms.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And that really plays into one of the reasons why this study was sponsored, is because there are conflicting regulations in this domain that leave investigators sort of in a quandary about how to deal with some of this information. There are some regulations that prohibit return of certain results, and there are regulations that require return of certain results. And in some situations, investigators are caught in the middle between those two regulations and not able to resolve that.
Now, among the new recommendations that this report makes is the simple fact that the decision about whether or not to return data to study participants shouldn't be made, you know, an absolute yes or an absolute no. This is a decision that should be made on a study-by-study basis. But did you identify particular types of studies that might be more appropriate for having that data returned, say these kinds of genetic studies?
Well, we want to maintain a core value, which is the quality of the information being returned. And one of the complexities in this domain is that some research laboratories are very high quality with exacting standards. Others are much less so and can be almost sort of a mom-and-pop shop at their level of quality control.
I mean, that's kind of a concerning statement in and of itself.
Well, it is. And that's why what we're recommending is that as folks begin in the research process to think about whether to return results, and we want to maintain that high quality. And so currently, regulations state that laboratories have to have a certain certification if you are going to return those results to participants. And we want to maintain that when there is a explicit plan to return results to people, then we want to maintain the highest quality of laboratory function. However, in those circumstances where people request their results, or in circumstances where you have a so-called incidental finding that you weren't anticipating, then we want the institution and the investigator in collaboration with research participants to sort of think that through, again, on a case-by-case basis, to say, what is the quality of the laboratory that generated this? How useful is this information to people? How feasible is it to return? And to make those sorts of calls on a case-by-case basis to make those decisions.
And one of the other recommendations, which makes total sense, is that you want to make sure people understand all of those complexities that you were just saying, not just do they understand that they have this gene or they don't have this gene, but how certain are they? What are the potential actions that could be taken as a result of that? Is that something that researchers on their own are really set up or even qualified to do? Or does this maybe require that researchers need to engage primary care physicians or genetic counselors or other people around their studies to help make sure that participants understand what they're getting back?
Yeah, in certain circumstances, the investigator, he or she may be a clinician who has lots of expertise in that particular domain, and they may be quite experienced and knowledgeable about how to communicate the information. In other circumstances, the investigator may be a basic scientist who doesn't have a clinical training and would not be oftentimes the right person to make this sort of communication. So here's where we would like to see more collaboration from clinicians and scholars who do have those capabilities so that the information can be communicated in a way that's likely to be most effective and likely to reduce the risk that people will overinterpret or misinterpret the information. And so this is going to be a gradual transition over time. And one of the things the report does is emphasize that we're not expecting the whole field to change quickly in response to this report. But what we'd like to see is an evolution over the next decade or so of these sorts of support systems for participants and investigators to make this communication more effective.
Well, I think some of that evolution was even reflected in the report, just in simple things like saying, okay, well, before you even start the study, you know, you need to be taking into consideration whether or not you're going to tell people, and things like when and how and where you would tell people, right? That it's not necessarily good enough to just say, oh, we're just going to send out a letter to our study participants. But you need to think about, oh, well, if you're giving unexpected information to a person, you might want to do that in a comfortable setting. You know, thinking about a level of details and personal interaction that, to me at least, seemed like it would be pretty new in the planning of a research study.
Well, that's right. And we really are encouraging folks to begin to think this through, both from the investigator standpoint and from the sponsor standpoint, at the very earliest stages of the developing the research protocol, so that you have those resources available. You have asked for the right level of funding to do this in a right way. And what we're trying to avoid is what has been part of the landscape over the last decade or so, again, probably more frequently in this genetics realm, where participants were told that, well, we're not going to give you any results back because we'll be uncertain about the results. But then they stumble across something that has significant clinical implications for the participants, and they're sort of caught off guard to say, oh, my goodness, what do we do? What do we do now with this? So we don't want those incidental surprises to arise. We want folks to be thinking as much as we can early in the process to do this in a comprehensive way.
And another thing that is noted is that researchers need to be thinking about diverse and different populations, different communities, in particular African American communities, who are very distrustful in some cases of biomedical researchers because of a past history of exploitation and unethical treatment. So how does that tie into this idea of potentially sharing research data with participants? Could that be a way of actually rebuilding some trust, potentially, if that's done well?
Yes, and that's central to the intent of this report, is to say that we are now seeing across many fronts a change in how people are thinking about the research enterprise, that this has to be something that is a much more collaborative activity with the participants, you know, for ethical reasons, but also for quite practical reasons, in that one of the biggest costs and complexities of doing clinical research is getting people to agree to participate, and then once they agree, keeping them in the study until the completion of the work.
That's Jeffrey Botkin. He is a professor of pediatrics and an adjunct professor of human genetics at the University of Utah, and he chaired a recent National Academies of Sciences committee that generated recommendations about sharing research results with study participants. Jeffrey, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.